everybody. Welcome back to ATL Developments with Jeff Smith, recording from the Business Radio X studios inside of Renaissance Bank in Alpharetta, where we talk about all things economic development throughout the metro Atlanta area. I'm a mortgage banker with Assurance Financial, and if you need a loan, please always feel free to reach out. But I write a weekly column that goes out in a newsletter and is run on the business pages of the Herald papers throughout North Fulton and Forsyth counties. If you want to get on my newsletter list or have a question about a mortgage, please email me at gsmith@assurancemortgage.com. That's gsmith@assurancemortgage.com. The metro Atlanta area has some truly amazing and talented people who have worked and are working to make it the success that it truly is today. One of those stories is that of my guest today, Egbert Perry. Perry is a native of Antigua and Barbuda, right? Pronounce that right?
Antigua and Barbuda.
Antigua and Barbuda.
Barbuda.
Barbuda, okay. Yes. Where he grew up on a chicken farm as one of 10 siblings. From that small farm, Perry won a scholarship to a private high school in New York. And correct me if I'm wrong here, but I took this from a newspaper from the Caribbean, the Caribbean Times, I think it was, but they had an article on you. Went on to study civil engineering at the University of Pennsylvania and earned an MBA at Wharton School of Business with majors in finance and accounting. From there, he went on to eventually own and operate the nation's third largest African-American-owned business, right?
Not right. So do I just pause you?
No, you go ahead and tell me. Cut right in. We're just having a conversation.
No, so the firm I was with,
yes,
H.J. Russell & Company, I was there from the days when it was a little smaller organization until it grew into the third largest.
Very good.
So I was only a part owner of the business, but not the owner.
Well, either way, it was a very impressive accomplishment. Mr. Perry became a very respected talent and was named board chairman of Fannie Mae right after the financial collapse and was charged with the task of being of righting that gigantic ship that was moving through the middle of the eye of that once-in-a-lifetime storm, hopefully once-in-a-lifetime storm. And he did right that ship. He and I'm sure he'll tell you a lot of the people he worked with. Since then, he's focused his time on managing his development company, the Integral Group. They are developing projects across the country and here in town with their complete redevelopment of the old GM plant in Doraville off I-285, which we'll talk a little bit about later. We will talk to Mr. Perry today about a lot of those things, but I wanted to specifically talk about his passion for wanting to create developments that include housing for people of all income levels. It's an issue that I've been talking about a lot on this show. And in Atlanta, you know, some of our cities have grown so well and become so successful that that has kind of come at a price. It's very hard to buy land in, say, Roswell, Alpharetta, or Milton, or really anywhere in town Atlanta, build housing under $300,000 and still make some sort of profit. Land has become too expensive. And as our last guest, Kerry Armstrong, chairman of the Atlanta Regional Commission, said, our businesses here maybe haven't increased their wages to keep up with the rising expenses, the rising housing expenses. That's another reason. So the people who work in our schools and our restaurants, our police and our fire officials, they can't afford to live in the cities they work in and protect. Perry has taken that on as a mission and has some solutions that I look forward to talking about. But really, enough of hearing from me. Egbert, welcome to our show. How are you doing?
Jeff, I'm doing fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here. You know, I always start this show out by Atlanta's a melting pot. We are made up of people from all over the country and sometimes all over the world. And so I always enjoy hearing about where somebody else grew up, what it was like there, and how they ended up here in Atlanta. So can you tell us a little bit about where you grew up and what life was like there?
Well, I am fortunate. I was actually born on a little speck on the map in the Eastern Caribbean, a little piece of rock, basically.
Yeah.
60,000 people back when I left home. That was the population of Antigua.
Okay.
And I finished my last 2 years of high school in New York. But back home in those days, I'm number 9 of 11 kids. I have 10.
11. Siblings. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was heaven on earth. 365 beaches, one for every day of the year.
Okay.
And, you know, life was great. But as is the case in a lot of the small islands, if you're going to school beyond high school, then you have to go to university, you have to go away because there's no university system on the island. So there's a perpetual brain drain as people leave the various islands to go away to study. And some return, most do not, and I'm unfortunately one of those in the latter category.
Fortunately for us, maybe unfortunately there. What was life like on that island? I mean, you say it was paradise. Growing up at the beach, you kind of lived it where most people like to vacation.
What made it special for me was, because, you know, there's that proverbial African village.
Okay.
It takes a village to raise a child.
Right.
And that was what I felt I grew up in. It wasn't about money. It wasn't about anything other than all the adults were looking out for the young people.
And
it was all about how can we help the young people be successful. And if that meant that I needed a spanking or whatever,
I got
that in doses. I probably got less than I deserve, but a lot more than most people.
Okay, all right.
But it was a nurturing, healthy, sustainable, and, you know, a child-centric community. And so in that respect, that's what made it heaven on earth.
And so this is a show about economic development, so I'm always curious, what was the economy like there? What did most people do, and, you know, what brought the jobs in, and what was that part of the world like down there?
Antigua is very much tourism-based.
And okay.
When you have a small country like that, it's not large enough to have big industry.
Right.
So it tends to be the fact that it had 365 beaches, what you're really exporting was an experience of being in this little paradise. And so tourism was the primary industry and still is today. It's probably 75% of the total economy.
So 365 beaches, I mean, there's a marketing concept built right into that. Isn't there a beach for every day of the year?
It is. And rest assured,
the
marketing gurus have long since picked up on that.
And dang.
I grew up knowing it to be exactly that, a beach for every day of the year.
I thought I had something there. Oh, well, I'll keep trying. Someone already thought of it. So I'd like to jump into the show. And before we jump into the main topic that I want to talk about, you know, I am a mortgage banker. And, you know, I have to ask you about being the chair of Fannie Mae. It wasn't just that you were one of the chairs of Fannie Mae. It was that you were the chair of Fannie Mae right after the collapse of what, you know, let's just be honest, back then, everybody, especially people in my industry, were quite frankly freaking out. I mean, there's just no cool way to put it. When you were on the board and you were involved and you had a front row seat to this whole entire thing, if you could just give folks just an idea of what the tone was like, what the atmosphere was like at that time, and what did you feel like was your mission, you know, when you took that on? I mean, it's a huge task to take on.
Well, so first of all, it was a privilege to have been selected. It was a burden at the same time, obviously.
Okay.
But there were 10 directors picked initially after Fannie and Freddie were put into conservatorship by the federal government. And so they recruited 10 of us for the Fannie Mae board and 10 for the Freddie Mac board, and I was one of those 10. I actually was not the chair until the second 5 years. So I was there for 10 years overall.
Okay.
The first five, there was a chairman, a guy by the name of Phil Laskaway.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came behind Phil for the last 5 years of my 10-year tenure as the board chair.
And what year was that you came in?
2014.
Okay.
I started early 2014 as chair. So we all came in December of 08.
Of 08.
And then there were some changes along the way. A couple of people went off, a few people were brought on, and so on. But there were a few of us that were there from the beginning for a 10-year term. And actually, there were two of us that did that.
And I'm imagining most boards, I think people imagine as people sitting around very measured, very calm, thinking about things, making decisions. But I'm trying to imagine that board in 08, and I'm imagining a ship with water coming in and everybody's got a bucket trying to throw the water out.
That imagery is a good one.
Is it? Okay.
You could say that if you think about it, Fannie Mae is the largest financial institution in the country.
Right.
By assets, maybe the world. So it holds 18 million mortgages, approximately, and is a $3.2 trillion organization. And probably the largest source of foreign direct investment into the country because of its agency securities that are sold around the world and
okay.
held almost like near cash
mm-hmm.
by a lot of financial institutions. And at the same time, if you think about the impact of that, Fannie Mae basically determined whether we had a housing finance system that was solvent.
Right.
And at the same time, the housing finance system, if it crashed, could take the entire U.S. economy down. And if it did that, could take down the global economy.
Right.
So we were not, this is not...
just a little bit of pressure on your right. shoulders.
Well, yeah. on the directors, but also I would say the people who really showed up every day at Fannie Mae and did the work. They're the ones, they're really the unsung heroes. Because
right.
you can imagine in those days, it was sort of embarrassing to be associated with Fannie and Freddie, unless you knew the facts. I mean, the
right.
average person on the street just said, oh, those guys crashed the economy and
right.
they're irresponsible and so on and so forth.
We all helped
None
out.
Of it, right. And yeah. absolutely. In fact, I would yeah. say if it was a football game, and I use that analogy often, if that whole episode was a football game leading up to the crash, then Fannie and Freddie entered the football game in the second half of the fourth quarter.
Okay.
So the damage, all of the bad foundational work to set up the economy for crash were done long before Fannie and Freddie entered into this the subprime market space.
Right.
And so their entry was late. It may have prolonged the date of the crash, postponed it by maybe 6 months, but all of the work that the damage had been done long before that.
Right.
And so you're sitting there watching a book of business that really ties back to people's homes and thinking there are a whole lot of people that are going to be damaged, families destroyed, wealth destroyed, coming out of that crash or as a result of that crash. And on the other side of it, a lot of people are going to make a lot of money off of those people's suffering.
I see.
So that's it's sort of sobering. It's sad because, in fact, some of the people that caused the crash on the front end profited on the back end.
Right. Right. And for those that don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, but Fannie Mae, one of the purposes of Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, FHA, and the VA's loan program is to take the risk off of the actual lenders to mitigate the risk so that they can offer lower interest rates and feel more comfortable taking a lower down payment. Before those organizations existed, it was not uncommon to have a 20 to 25% interest rate, have to put 50% down. And those organizations essentially guarantee the loans. The only risk on the bank and the lender is that you underwrite the loan properly.
That's a pretty accurate assessment. And I always emphasize that Fannie and Freddie are secondary mortgage market players.
Okay.
In other words, they don't originate any mortgages.
That's right.
But whoever originates the mortgages, mortgage bankers, for example,
that's right.
Originate the mortgages and then they sell them to aggregators, could be large banks or so, or now even to Fannie and Freddie, who then monetize those mortgages for that lender so they can go out and do it again and again and again.
That's right.
And as we aggregate enough mortgages, we bundle them, put them as a Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac security, and then sell them into the broader marketplace as an investment. And that way we're bringing in foreign direct investment or just investment period.
Right.
So we can turn around and recycle those dollars. So that's how the mortgage system continues to work. So in the secondary market position, we provide liquidity, stability, and affordability to the mortgage system.
Right.
So that originators on the front line can actually underwrite mortgages and place mortgages.
Absolutely. And make it easier for people to own a home.
That's correct.
And I don't want to go too much in the weeds in this, but I do want to touch on one last thing. Just when y'all were clearly there were some fixes that needed to happen, some gates that needed to be put up at Fannie Mae, the system got taken advantage of, and you know, people talk about it. They made it impossible to get a loan. The qualifications, I mean, I'm a mortgage banker. They're not really all that stringent. You know, I can see where if somebody's going outside of some of these qualifications, you know, maybe it's not a wise idea for them to be owning that kind of a home. But I think there was a lot of redundancy and checks and balances that were put in place at the time. And of course, the pendulum swung the other way for all the banks that were getting licenses pulled, and people were going a little overboard on our side to just make sure that we were doing our due diligence and double checking all the paperwork that was coming in, double checking incomes, down payment sources, and all that kind of stuff. But what kind of things, if you could just touch on it just a little bit, what kind of changes did y'all make that you think helped to safeguard against this kind of thing happening again? Obviously, it's not all up to Fannie Mae to safeguard that. We all need to pitch in and help. But from your perspective, what kind of...
That's a good question. And the list is very long. And let me say, there were checks and balances put in place across the system. And Fannie Mae's board didn't save the company.
Right.
Certainly no director did.
Right.
The management team did, but with the help and support of our regulators, because FHFA played a pretty critical role there.
Okay.
The Federal Reserve, because they bought a lot of the securities when the market was not very liquid.
Right.
They bought a lot of securities, agency securities, which allowed us to keep doing the business we were doing. So there were a lot of people and organizations that played a part in this. But more tactically, some of the things we did included, prior to this crash, we relied on, it's a rep and warrant model. We relied on the representation of the financial institution providing us the mortgages that they met the requirements.
Right.
Well, and we did that and had been doing it for decades. The reality is, what happens if there's a lot of it originated that didn't meet the requirements, notwithstanding that it was represented that they did? All of a sudden, you wake up one day and find out these things that you considered to be top quality instruments were no longer all that good. And you would put your John Henry on it to say, consider this a nice, safe, and secure instrument. And you wake up and find out that, in fact, they're not.
That's right.
And I think we then started to do our own looking at all the loans that come in.
More due diligence,
absolutely, on the front end. So for the first time, we actually examined all of the mortgages that were coming in, notwithstanding the representations that were being made.
Right.
That was added cost, but a great insurance policy so that there was a check against the representations that were being made. And a lot of tighter controls. I mean, we limited how many things we did that may have been outside of the box. Now, at no time did we ever get outside of our credit box.
Okay.
But it just meant that as we tightened certain things, we woke up one day and realized we were only serving a certain part of our credit box, the very low LTVs and very high FICO scores. And so, you know, that really wasn't what we were supposed to be doing. So a big part of the last few years that I was on the board, we were trying to find ways to serve a greater portion of our credit box without taking on water in the process.
Okay. Still keeping the checks and balances in place by taking on what some would consider more risky.
Absolutely.
More risky loans.
And serving people who are still great credit quality, but didn't necessarily fall in the upper end of those two metrics.
Well, as somebody who came out of that crash and became a mortgage banker, I can tell you there was not a lot of people that had very high credit scores coming out of that. A lot of people got hit pretty hard on the credit issue. So it's fascinating stuff, and really that's a whole show in itself, and I would have been wrong not to have at least talked about it a little bit, because it was really interesting to talk to somebody who had that kind of a front row seat and that kind of an organization during that time, historic stuff. But what I'm kind of passionate about and what we've talked about on the show a lot is something that I saw you are also very passionate about, or at least you were trying to put a shock into the Roswell Rotary Club when I heard you speak. You might have been trying to do a little bit of both. But, you know, I know we're all fortunate to be living in such a prosperous and well-to-do metro area of Atlanta. And even in those dark days, it was still one of the safest and best places to live on the planet. But it still gives me the creeps going back to that place. So we'll kind of, let's jump out of there and get back to modern times where, you know, we've come a long way, which brings us to the subject at hand. After the collapse, our home values dropped significantly. But since then, they've risen to a point where it's hard for many people to buy them. We have 90,000 people a year moving to the metro Atlanta area because our economy is so great and there's so many jobs being created. But developers are having trouble figuring out how to make money building houses under $300,000. So supply is low, demand is growing, which is making those houses, housing values jump in value quickly, which is exacerbating the whole entire problem. And so that's the economics of it. But when I heard you speak at Roswell Rotary, you had a lot to say about this being a moral issue as well. And talking about giving the same opportunities to those children and people making less money than those that are making more. And can you talk about that a little bit? You know, why is it critical as a community to make sure that less affluent people can have more, can live in more affluent areas? Can you talk a little bit about that side of things? Yeah, why is it, why do we need that? Yeah.
It is a moral issue, and of course, some of what I say is provocative, and it shocks the conscience of some people who would like to believe that they are where they are because they're better than people who are not in as good a financial position. Many people would love to believe that we live in a meritocracy. The fact is, we don't.
Right.
We have been very, throughout the history of the country and a lot of other countries, we have been very intentional about stratifying people by income. Mm-hmm. And then opportunity is then not democratized, but restricted heavily towards those people who actually have those economic means. So you tend to create the haves and have-nots. And if you really want to address or talk about solving problems in society, you have to first be grounded in those facts and get away from the delusional view of the world we live in. And I tell people, it's important to put yourself into it. So if you think you're doing something to help someone, if you want to know if you're doing the right thing, assume that that person that you're trying to help is yourself or somebody that you love or care about.
Right.
And you'll probably be making the right decision. But the minute you make it impersonal, like you're doing it for those people.
Right.
Chances are mind over matter kicks in. And mind over matter for me means you don't mind making bad policy and bad decisions because the people that are destroyed or damaged by your bad policy don't matter.
Right.
And so until you personalize it and let your decisions be driven as if the object of your actions is someone that is dear and close and personal to you, because that usually means you're going to make decisions that are logical, right, and rational, and don't assume that people of lesser means have different aspirations than what you have. I think people generally want to see their kids do better than they did. They'd love their kids to get a great education, live in a healthy and safe environment, etc., etc. Well, you know, because I have less means doesn't mean I no longer have those aspirations. They're just less attainable than they are for people with means.
Excellent. So, you know, so the big question is, if we all agree that it's important to, from a moral issue, and I said this on at when Carrie was on here too, because we were talking about it. You know, if I live in an affluent area, I live in Roswell. Okay. I'm not one of the most affluent in Roswell by any stretch of the imagination. But, you know, I was at a restaurant. I told the story on the last show. I'm going to tell it again to set the stage. I was at a restaurant where I had to wait 45 minutes, you know, to get my food at the restaurant. I ordered. It took 45 minutes. The manager came over. He was throwing gift cards at us, giving us free drinks. And apologizing, and I said, what's going on? What's the problem? He said, well, I can't keep a chef here because he's having to drive an hour or an hour and a half just to get here. They can't afford to live here. There's not affordable housing. So there's indirect ways that not having affordable housing, as you described, will affect our lives, in that you're putting people in, people are having to go to areas where they don't have as many opportunities as you may have in more affluent areas. And then there's direct ways as well that we're being impacted there. And so now the question is, okay, this all sounds great, but the facts are still that it's very hard to build the $300,000 and under house in an affluent area where the land is expensive. So I know you've put your mind to that, and you've been able to do that in some of your developments and are trying to do that. Can we dive in a little bit about, if I'm a developer or if I'm a city planner, right? What kind of things can we do? What are available to us? How can we economically make that happening without it being a government subsidized project or something like that? How can we work to make a free market do that?
Okay. That's a great question. I always think of the issue that you see playing out with gentrification as an example today.
Yeah.
You have to go back a bit to understand how we got here. And how we got here is the failure to acknowledge the need for public policy and private investment to be reconciled. There's a gap between the two. If you go for a long time without ensuring that there's some public policy overlay on private activity, you get bad outcomes. The idea that we have such a thing as free market is false.
Right.
The freest market will be everybody out for themselves. There are no laws, there are no rules, survival of the fittest, etc.
Right.
That's not what we have. So we have selectively chosen to overlay some things to control or regulate human behavior. And then we say, okay, we want the free markets to work. Well, if we really thought free market economics by itself would take care of everything, we never would have come up with all of these other things. So what has happened is we have failed to intervene in the process where straight market dynamics work at odds with what's good for community. So I draw a distinction between commercial real estate and community development. If you're developing communities, the important word in that label of community development is the adjective community. It's about people.
Mm-hmm.
It's about transformations. It's about quality of life. It's about Main Street. Commercial real estate is about the dollar, the return, the economics, Wall Street, the deal. And if we want healthy, nurturing communities, we can't create heaven and hell without expecting hell to eventually contaminate heaven.
Okay.
So if you're going to create sustainable communities where people, independent of income, can have access to decent economic opportunities, because they have gotten access to decent educational opportunities, that doesn't happen on its own. Somebody's making policy somewhere that makes that either attainable or unattainable based on income. And in this country, we've done a good job of stratifying people by virtue of their income and then making sure that a decent education is only made available to those people with means. The people who have very little means, they get crapped on. They get a bad education. They're going to live in a bad neighborhood, not nurturing, not healthy, not sustainable. And we're going to produce people that are on further down the have-nots chain while we're producing people on the haves chain. And we're widening the gap. And the question is, when do supposedly good people with their hearts in the right places, when do they step up and say, this model doesn't work? Because it hasn't been working for decades. It doesn't work. And until we acknowledge that and realize there's a need to change status quo and admit that we've been failing a lot of people for a long time, based on how we define your worth and your value, strictly on the basis of economics, we're going to continue to have
down the path. And so let's just say, we've got, and I assume you're saying that because you're saying in order to be able to build houses that would buck the market trend mm-hmm. and be more what we would say is affordable, mm-hmm. You're going to need public policy put in place to help that
Correct.
Along.
Correct.
And in order to get public policy, you've got to have the political will
yes.
in order to do that. In other words, the acceptance of the voters in a particular community for those politicians to put that kind of policy in place, they need to have the political will and the ability and the acceptance of their voters. And so that's why you're going at a very grassroots level when we say that.
Sure. When somebody says,
yeah.
not in my backyard.
Right.
Because they don't want somebody of lower income living in their community. And then they go to church on Sunday and talk about being a Christian and a this and a that, or mm-hmm. they talk about their great heart. You know, I mean, maybe they can lie to themselves, and if all the people around them are in the same bubble, they can continue to live in that bubble. But the truth is, part of, if you think we have a problem today with housing affordability. People say affordable housing. I say housing affordability. It's not just a housing issue. I say repeatedly, it's a community development issue.
Right.
Because if you build just housing, let's say I wove a magic wand and I could build 50,000 units or homes very inexpensively so that they're now affordable to people who make anywhere from $15,000 a year to $500,000 a year, but they're certainly affordable to people on the low end. Will we have solved the problem? I don't think so. Not if that housing, in order to get it built that inexpensively, you have to locate it in a crappy neighborhood.
I see.
A neighborhood that has bad schools, has no access to transportation, no economic vitality. So it's not about just building the housing and making the housing more affordable. It's having that affordability in places where you or I would want to live.
Right.
And if we are building it in a place where we wouldn't want to live and we say, good, we've done a good day's work and we've solved the problem.
Right.
Look again. And that's why I said earlier on, if you put yourself in the place of the consumer of that house and you wouldn't want to be there, don't build it. You're not solving the problem. You're just creating tomorrow's problems today at a more accelerated rate.
And just to explain to the listeners, you know, what we're talking about here, when you talk about it being hard to build affordable housing on a piece of property, what Mr. Perry was just talking about is basically he could build 50,000 on a much smaller lot, maybe a much more dense. So if a city could possibly allow for a higher density in a better part of town, that would enable a developer to now be able to build that those less expensive houses or less expensive townhomes or whatever they may be. So offering, you know, a higher density to a developer with the stipulation maybe that a certain percentage of those homes are quote unquote affordable for that area. I know they're doing a lot of that stuff along the Beltline.
Yes.
They're putting those policies in place. It was one of the reasons that the original designer of the Beltline, Ryan Grable, left, because they were not putting those things in place.
And when you really look at it, it's happening across the country, because I think it was Winston Churchill who said that you can always count on the U.S. to do the right thing after it's exhausted every other option. Well,
right.
That's how a lot of people are.
Right.
You resist, you resist, you resist. And there are people who think that if you have people of lesser income living anywhere in their neighborhoods, that devalues their neighborhood. And I would ask you, if you live in a place where you can't get a workforce to come, because the place is unaffordable, does that devalue your neighborhood? I think so too.
Right.
So it's all about, for those who can't quite get there at the heart, that's fine. Then get there at the economics. Appeal to them on the basis of economic impact to them. So if they're not predisposed to care about their fellow man and only care about themselves, then have them understand how it pays, it goes against them financially if the community isn't livable except for people at the top end of the market.
That's right.
Because those people are not manning the waiter jobs and the custodian jobs and all the other things necessary to sustain and maintain a community.
That's right. And even looking further off into the next generation, what is the next generation of people in all of our areas and communities going to be like? You know, if we don't reach out and help everybody, it's about those children. We're predicting our future in that way, aren't we?
Correct. In fact, we are predetermining our future.
So the assembly yards down in Doraville. And so, by the way, if you don't know what this is a massive project on the old GM plant that had remained vacant for years. And it's, I've got some of the stuff here. It's basically a not so small city that's being built right there south of 285, right next to the Doraville MARTA station. It started off with a big Third Rail Film Studios, which is film major motion pictures. And since then, it's got a company headquarters, CERTA, right? I believe is going up.
Yes.
Plenty of retail, hotel, townhomes, multifamily. Spill has a lot of space to grow. I think you also incorporated a tax allocation district. Is that into the project or was that next to it?
It's actually both.
It's both.
The project is in it, but there's land adjacent to the project that is also included in that tax allocation district.
And so for those that don't know, we talked about CIDs once before. It's very similar where it's a geographical area where the commercial property owners in that area pay an added tax, if you will, that goes into a pot that those commercial property owners all decide on how it gets spent within that district. Yeah. It's another way for them to have excess dollars and pull together money to keep improving the district.
It so happens that Assembly is a CID and has a TAD. So we have taxing authority on the within the confines of the Assembly site, but the area impacted outside of Assembly that will also see significant movement in the tax increment as our work causes the area to be uplifted, allows us to capture some of the incremental property tax revenue to help pay for some of the infrastructure needed to put in roads and sewer and other public assets into the area.
And it's a great way. We had a whole show on a CID before, and it's a great way to just keep making sure that there's constant investment in what's going on and keeping the infrastructure looking modern and keeping them up to speed. You know, a lot of times in cities, it's hard for them to find the money to do things like, you know, upgrade the sidewalks. It's a very expensive endeavor. And if you can get those property owners to do that, then it's going to come back on them in keeping their place out in front fresh and nice. And they're not dependent upon the local government to look out for them in that way. Right. And certainly not depending on how they're not worrying about local government, how they're going to spend those funds. They have control over that.
That's right.
So it's an interesting thing, but in terms of what we were talking about can you tell me a little bit about the mixed income portion of Assembly Yards and how you folded that into that project? Because I know you talked a little bit about doing that.
Right? Well, we think of mixed income, what we're trying to do is make sure that the communities we create have a mix of incomes for all the reasons that I spoke to earlier.
Right.
But if an area already has a heavy concentration on one end of that spectrum, then you're not trying to recreate on every piece of dirt this mixed income fabric. What you're trying to do is make the community a mixed income community. So Doraville already has significant affordable housing.
Okay.
So what we're trying to do is have a mix that is now more skewed towards the higher end of the income spectrum while also having some percentage of affordability in there so that you're not building at the two extremes.
Right.
And so in our housing solutions, we will always have around 20% of the units we develop on the site. We'll make sure at least 20% of that is affordable throughout the big zone that includes Assembly and some adjacent property.
And it's a lot easier to do that kind of thing on a huge property like this. Correct. It's much harder to do on much smaller scale properties because there just simply isn't the space to play around with very much. That was a huge, before we get too close to the end here, that was just a huge project in general. And it's really going to change the whole landscape of that whole area and certainly the whole landscape of Doraville. Doraville has just, in my mind, it's elevated this whole project to a place where people are going to want to live and want to move to. It's got a huge cool factor with it. It's on the rail line, which everybody says all the millennials want to be near that rail line. Employees are fighting to be near the rail line because unemployment's so low and they're fighting each other for employees. And if you're close to something like that, it's going to make people want to work for you. When you first looked at that property, how did that even come about, the idea of you wanting to take on such a monumental project here in the Atlanta area?
This is actually embarrassing to say,
but
I got involved in the project by accident. A friend of mine kept harassing me to go and look at the site.
Okay.
Big, empty. It had 90 acres of buildings on it.
Mm-hmm.
And said, this is a great location, and you need to go and see it. And I said, oh, I'm not going out there. And I said that for probably a year or so. And then I decided, okay, finally, I'm going to get you off my back. You're annoying the dickens out of me.
Right.
And I went out there, looked at it, and it had so many multimodal bones. It had two entrances and exits off of the interstate. It had one transit station right next to the site and one a little bit down the street. It was 2 miles away from PDK. It had so many things that were attributes that it made sense. So that made us look at it. And I will say, I can't believe I'm saying this, but thank God for millennials.
Yeah.
Because they understand and appreciate transit, outdoor spaces, connectivity. Their taste buds are different from the taste buds of the older generation. We wanted big spaces and we wanted to be inside with big air conditioned spaces. They want to be outside. So they're good for the planet.
Yep.
Because we were not.
Yep.
And so there are a lot of things that made that site's attributes appealing to what we think the future is. Now, we're just scratching the surface. We're 15% of the way through the project. So we have a long way to go.
Right. And it's still morphing as you build it, right?
Absolutely. We'll respond to the market and the market will dictate for us what...
How you finish it up.
Exactly.
And it's right near Buford Highway, correct, which has... got national acclaim for absolutely the diversity, the food that is along that. If you don't know, I mean, Buford Highway's got national acclaim from everything from Anthony Bourdain's show to national publications for the diversity of food and ethnic opportunities that are there. So, drive up and down there for all kinds of different food you can eat all over the world. Which makes it even cooler. I mean, it's got a high cool factor there, and now you're right next to it. Now you can be next to the assembly plant where there's going to be a downtown, basically, and and places to walk around and major motion pictures being filmed. I mean, you don't get a whole lot cooler than that in Atlanta.
That's right.
So I've just been notified that we've been going on for 40 minutes, which makes this one of my longest shows ever. It went by really, really fast.
I think the message there is I talk too much and too long. So sorry about that.
Well, and I would have stopped you a lot shorter if it wasn't interesting stuff. So the good news is that you say good things that certainly at least I find entertaining and interesting. So I guess one last thing is, where does Egbert Perry go from here? Is it just one day at a time, or do you have anything on the horizon, or what happens next? President of the United... No, I'm just kidding.
I was actually...
Yeah.
Born in a foreign country.
Yeah, that's right. You were. That's true. Okay, well, check that off the list.
Thank you. Yes. No, I don't have any of those kinds of aspirations.
Right.
But no, I mean, I live my life just trying to see how I can make a difference and in my own little way. And I'm not trying to impress anybody. I'm just trying to do what I think I can do. And I don't know what tomorrow brings. I'll keep doing what I'm doing and the path will change as the opportunities or how I think I can create impact changes.
Well, I just can't thank you enough for coming on the show. And the listeners, I'm sure, can't thank you enough as well. It's been really interesting information. And I look forward to going home and listening to it myself. But it's been a pleasure to sit across from you, and thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Jeff. My pleasure.
Absolutely. And folks, that wraps up another edition of ATL Developments with Jeff Smith. We'll hope to join you next month. I'll let you know who the guest is when we record the show next month. Thank you, John Ray, and everybody here at Renaissance Bank, and we'll see you soon.